tonight on Arena with me, Ciara King. Up for review on TV, The Death of Bunny Monroe, Landman and A Man on the Inside, and in music, albums from De La Soul, Aerosmith and Stray Kids. Now, as always, you can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is 087-032-3232. You can email us to arena@rte.ie and we're on Instagram at @rte_arena. Now, Matt Smith stars in The Death of Bunny Monroe, adapted from Nick Cave's 2009 novel. Smith plays Bunny, the promiscuous travelling salesman who has lost his wife to suicide. Suddenly responsible for his grieving, sensitive 9-year-old son, Bunny flees social services with his son by taking a road trip along England's south coast. Paramount Plus takes us back to Texas in Landman Season 2. Billy Bob Thornton is back playing Tommy Norris, the chain-smoking crisis manager for Emtex. Following Monty Millard's shocking death, Tommy grapples with cartel threats, legal battles and family turmoil. While at home, his daughter is leaving for college and Cammy, played by Demi Moore, seizes control. And lastly, tonight, Netflix brings us A Man on the Inside Season 2, with Ted Danson returning as his role as a retired professor, now posing as a lecturer at Wheeler College looking for a blackmailer. This time, he teams up with private investigator Julie and friend Mona, played by Danson's real-life wife. I've got Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser in studio. They've watched all three and they join me now. I'm delighted to have you in. We're going to start with The Death of Bunny Monroe. And I just want to say, before we kind of get into this particular TV show, just a little warning, if there's any little ears listening to that happen to be listening to Arena right now, it's probably best maybe to just turn down the radio a little bit. To The Death of Bunny Monroe, it began life as a novel by the Australian barman Nick Cave. It stars Matt Smith, and he's been both Doctor Who and he's been the Duke of Edinburgh, and he's now Bunny Monroe, who's a sex addict and an alcoholic. And this show also stars as well the Irish actress Sarah Green. Chris, let's start with, what's the story here?
The story is that we spend a lot of time with Matt Smith, Bunny Monroe. That is his real name. Well, at least we think it is. And he thinks a lot of himself. He is this self-proclaimed Lothario. He is a sex addict. He drinks far too much. He only really cares about, you know, who he's going to have sex with next, basically. And he completely ignores the fact that he has this adoring wife, Libby, played by Sarah Green at home, and also a 9-year-old kid played by, who's also named Bunny Jr., played by a newcomer named Raphael Mathay, who's brilliant in this. So he is a door-to-door traveling salesman in and around the Brighton area, and he is always telling his wife over the phone that he's away, far away on business, but he might actually be down the road in a hotel selling beauty products to women and then sleeping with those women. He comes home at the beginning of the series after his latest trip to find his house quite, you know, rather quiet. The kid should be in school but hasn't actually been in school in months. He didn't know this. And he also finds his wife dead at home. She has taken her own life. So a funeral is arranged. We get to see what way the Bunny is with Libby's parents. The response from Libby's parents and friends tell us that, you know, he's not just horrible to her. They know the truth about this man, that he is only in it for himself. He's the worst human being you've ever encountered. But following the funeral, he realizes that he's going to have to, you know, accept responsibility as a parent. And most people might, you know, try and clean themselves up and sort their lives out. For Bunny, because social services are knocking at the door, they know what he's like. It involves basically kidnapping his own son, you know, taking his kid on this road trip in and around Brighton, you know, selling beauty products, continuing to sleep with women, and setting a very, very bad example for his son, all the while trying to, you know, cope with his grief and his guilt. The same with the son.
Let's get a little taster of what Bunny kind of sounds like. Here is Bunny having breakfast in a hotel, and he starts up this really awkward conversation with the waitress called River.
Beautiful.
What?
River. That's a fucking beautiful name.
Yeah. My mum called me it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Because I was born near a river.
Huh. Hmm. Lucky you weren't born near a toilet. Guess what my name is? I'm Bunny.
Bunny?
Bunny.
Well, suddenly river doesn't seem so bad.
Here. Ta-da. Now, take this.
What is it?
Only the finest hand cream known to mankind. Elastin rich, extra relief, silky smooth.
You sell this, yeah?
But you can have it free. Bloody miraculous stuff.
That will just give you a taste of the kind of the smarminess of this character, Bunny Monroe. And Matt Smith, Jen, is such a tremendous actor. Like, I think he's brilliant. I thought he was brilliant in The Crown. But how does he fare playing such an unlikable character in this TV series?
It's difficult because Bunny Monroe is a strange archetype. He's not a full-blooded character. It is Nick Cave's, when he wrote the book, it's an approximation of the baser instincts of the male species. It's about stupidity, it's about violence, it's about dark sexual fantasies. So it's hard to, it's a mean feat for an actor to try and make him flesh and blood, to make him a human. And I think Smith is playing Bunny in this very deliberate way. There are times when he chooses to embody the character with this over-exaggerated swagger that you kind of feel that Bunny doesn't even believe himself, if you know what I mean. So the character is a confidence trick, and it's a confidence trick that Matt Smith has to play on the screen. So he's code switch. You can hear him there where he's at one point he's a London wide boy. And then he turns up to be the suited up salesman and back again. And neither of them are the real Bunny. And neither of them get close to that kind of core of who this man is. And it's a tough, slippery role to try and get a handle on. I've never been a big Matt Smith fan before. And I think here he's trying his best to negotiate this material. But I think it's all surface level because Bunny Monroe is a pose. It's quite an affected performance. And there are moments where he does break through and it feels believable. But it's such a challenge because I think when you're looking at the book, what Nick Cave was writing was, it felt like it was pretty much in the realm of those twin testosterone novels of the 90s and 2000s that you would have from, say, Will Self or Martin Amis. So I feel like Bunny Monroe is like a Keith Tallant character. Okay. Mm. And that doesn't really give your actor enough to play with to make him three-dimensional, which is difficult. You feel that this show in itself is a little bit soulless because of that.
Mm-hmm. And we also have the Cork actress Sarah Green. Who does she play?
She plays Libby. So she plays Bunny Monroe's late wife. And we see from various flashbacks that, you know, at the beginning of their relationship, they were mad about each other. But after they married and had their son, there was clearly only one participant in that marriage who was, you know, still in love. And Bunny had this sort of meltdown, you know, this private inner meltdown where he was thinking, I'm not ready to be a father. I'm not ready to settle down. That's why he runs away. And after he disappears, you know, from the marriage, from their lives, Libby is depressed, which unfortunately then does lead to her death. The idea of bringing Libby into it as a sort of imaginary advisor for little Bunny, Bunny Junior, that is, the kid, that didn't really sit well with me. I mean, there's an awful lot to dislike about this show. The idea of a serial killer also running around that's dressed like the devil, that bit's very, very strange. We can come back to that. But the Sarah Green character, she sits with little Bunny and she talks to him about his day when he's been left by himself, or she visits him at night to say goodnight. And I just thought that sort of heavy handed sort of fantasy element didn't really sit well with some of the more serious drama in this.
I was chatting about Train Dreams last night, and that was based on a novel by Dennis Johnson, and I had kind of had this moment where I wish I'd read the book before I'd seen the movie. And I had the same feeling when I watched Trespasses by Louise Kennedy recently. Is it a case of reading this book first? Jen, you have read this book by Nick Cave.
Yeah, and I think the book itself, I remember it caused a lot of controversy when it came out in 2009. I remember it being nominated for the Bad Sex Award in novels. And there's a lot of brutal misogyny going on in the book, and it has to be reflected within the show. There's this driving narrative about this craven, sex-addicted loser who lusts after stars like Avril Lavigne and Kylie Minogue in very sickening detail. And that has to be dialed down for this. And you get the point that he's trying to make about the casual sexual cruelty of misogyny. But I felt like it was always out of step. It felt like a novel, a book from the 1970s or maybe the 80s and 90s. Mm. And the show feels the same. I don't know what era this show is supposed to be
in. I was just about to say that to the two of you. I started off watching the show and I'm four episodes in and I went, oh, it's set in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And then I was like, no, wait a second. This is in the 70s. what era is it? Is it the
I think it's 2003, around the West Pier fires in Brighton. But I mean, I had to look that up. And it wasn't until actually Bunny Monroe takes out his flip phone that you kind of get a sense of the time. And also the Avril Lavigne, like at one stage you hear Avril Lavigne's Complicated, or when he gets into his car, you hear Kylie Minogue's Can't Get You Out of My Head. And I thought maybe that's I thought innocently at the beginning that that was just a joke about the fact that Nick Cave and Kylie obviously had this history. But then I learned that in the book, the inner monologue from Bunny is way worse than anything we actually see.
It's very dark and it's very extreme. And I think, you know, he was trying to make this comment about men and society and that hidden maybe side to men that you don't know about, and that long shadow of misogyny that runs right through a family, because it's about how he's shaping Bunny Jr. And Bunny Jr. is so open to his charismatic father as Bunny Sr. was to his own father, and he was enthralled to him, and he was also neglectful. So it's about that cycle of, you know, that misogyny that runs through a family, or that carelessness about how men can treat their own children, can treat their spouses. So it's a hard watch. It's a hard sell for six episodes, I think.
Some positives, though. I would say the soundtrack is really, really good. And then obviously Brighton and, you know, the cinematography of how it's actually shot.
Yeah, I think the director, like Isabel Elkoff, is it? I think she has to be commended for trying to make it as entertaining a journey, as beautiful as it can be. And the show looks exquisite. It does help that it's shot around Brighton, like Cave's adopted hometown. And it's about that off-season seaside town, the strangeness of those inhabitants of it's a place that's built for pleasure, and what happens in the off-season. And that's the feeling that you're getting with Bunny as you're going with him through this. And it probably has my favourite title sequence ever this year.
Yeah, that's true.
I felt like a bang of Succession off the, I don't know, the intro to it, but I was mesmerised and taken by that as well.
It's like, so the Brighton Pier, you know, it's on fire, and then you have this sea foam coming around, lapping to the sounds of Nick Cave. Like, who wouldn't want to watch this?
It is interesting that Nick Cave and Warren Ellis, they were involved. Like, it's not just based on Nick Cave's book. I mean, he was directly involved in the series, and he has been giving interviews saying that it's taken the best part of a decade and a half to actually get this thing to screens. At first it was an idea for a film, then a TV series, and a lot of that was down to the fact that no actor wanted to play this part. And I think that's the fundamental flaw with this thing, that you can't, I mean, I know television and film is full of horrible wrongdoers and troublemakers, and, you know, we don't always need to be rooting for characters, but it's so difficult to spend even half an hour with this chap. And I think that's what will make or break this series for a lot of people. Despite that, Raphael Matei as the unbunny Monroe is very impressive. Sarah Green's character isn't great, but she is. And I think Matt Smith, despite the fact that the character is horrible, he's all in. You know, you can't say he's not committed to this.
Jen, finally, the title is The Death of Bunny Monroe. Is that a spoiler?
It is. It isn't, it isn't. I mean, I think the thing about this is you're going deeper and deeper and darker into this world, and it feels a bit like Paper Moon, you know, the scam element of it with the young child, but then it also feels a bit like Fear and Loathing too sometimes in that way. And that's where they're taking you. They're taking you on this journey. Whether or not you want to continue with it is another thing. I feel it's a bit, you know, fur coat, no knickers, which I think the protagonist would appreciate.
Absolutely.
It's a bit of a flimsy enough idea that Nick Cave had at the wry look at the degradation of the male psyche, and stretched over six episodes, if it can be a bit too empty. It leaves feeling quite empty, I think.
Okay, Chris, how many stars?
Yeah, I just found it a bit charmless, unfortunately. If you are to give it a go, maybe do it one episode at a time. Don't binge it like I did. So it has to be 2 stars, I'm afraid.
Okay, Jen?
I'll give it 2.5 because I think there's some great ideas there and it looks gorgeous. And as I said, the soundtrack is great, but as a person, I don't know if you want to spend that much time with him.
Okay, all right. Now, on to Landman Season 2, the macho, cynical Texas oil drama. It's back for a second season on Paramount. Plus, Chris, last season, a heart attack killed off the larger-than-life character, Monty Miller, played by John Hamm. So where does that leave our protagonist, Tommy Norris, played by Billy Bob Thornton, in Series 2?
Don Draper didn't survive Landman. So the person who ran MTex Oil, the main boss, he is now dead, which means that the Landman, played by Billy Bob Thornton, his name is Tommy Norris, he's sort of the in-between. He's the guy that goes between, you know, the wildcat billionaires, the roughnecks and the engineers, you know, in the West Texas oil region. And he kind of cools, you know, he's putting out fires, real fires and metaphorical ones. And it's his job to make a lot of money, not just for himself, but for the people he works for. And in this second season, because the head of MTex Oil is dead, he has been promoted to president. John Hamm's character, Monty Miller, his widow, Cammy, played by Demi Moore, she is now the person in charge. But the two of them, when they bang their heads together, they realise, uh-oh, we're in trouble here. Monty Miller was actually up to his ears in debt. You know, there's really no money there whatsoever. There's an added complication now with Andy Garcia's gangster from the first season potentially entering the fold in the second one. And then you've also got, you know, the familial complications with Tommy's character, where he's back with his wife, which means that he might have he might have to buy a new house. God love him. He also has to spend more time with his daughter, who's looking to enroll in university. And then his son is now in the oil business himself and has basically started drilling down the road from MTEX and is, you know, starting to become very successful in that field. So there's an awful lot going on for Tommy in this series.
Okay, so I never watched Landman season one, and I believe, Jen, that it was a very kind of macho affair in series one. Has Taylor Sheridan made more of an effort? Actually, I know the answer to this question before I even ask you. Do you think, I mean, it must have been really bad in season one, but do you think Taylor Sheridan made more of an effort with the female characters this season?
No, not at all. Actually, I think it's regressed. It's possibly even worse. Like, I mean, I think in season one, we had to worry about a guy that worked for Tommy leering at his teenage daughter, bouncing all around the house. That was such a weird subplot in season one. And this season, it's the headache for Norris is women. The women in Landman are painful. They're there to get in the way of the menfolk and their real important work. And it makes you wonder about what Taylor Sheridan thinks of women, or what, more importantly, I think, what he thinks his audience think about women. Like, they are a complete nuisance. I was cheered when I saw that Demi Moore would have actual lines in this season because she didn't last time, really. And she's probably the only redeemable woman in this show.
Okay, do you know what we'll do? Let's hear Demi Moore as Cammy. She's hosting a lunch for the oil community, and she makes a speech after it begins.
I called this luncheon so I could introduce myself to each of you, to squash the rumors and offer you a warning. I'm a hunter too, and like my husband, I don't use a rifle. We are entering the largest energy boom of this century. For those of you coasting on your royalties, I must point out that while you sunburn on the beach in Tulum, I will be underbidding your lease offers, cornering pipeline supplies, and buying your bad debt. Underestimating me is how I buy you out. Now, I have no speech on the futures of energy or my commitment to innovative approaches on drilling or philanthropy or any of that other bullshit you guys like to spew with these things. I'm the largest independent oil producer in the region. The only difference between me and Monty is I'm meaner. Test me and you'll find out how much. Enjoy your lunch. I paid for it with your fucking money.
All right, Demi Moore there playing Cammy. Jen, I want to go back to a scene. I watched one episode and I couldn't bring myself to watch a second episode. So that's where I'm at with it, okay?
Yeah.
And bear in mind, I watched all of Yellowstone. I also watched 1883 and 1923, okay? So don't judge me.
Well done.
But there is a scene that is set around the dinner table, and the mother, Angela, has bought some very expensive truffles. Talk to me about that.
So this is a celebratory meal for their idiot daughter, and obviously Angela doesn't understand what truffles are exactly, but she knows that they're expensive. You know, women, they know the value of nothing. They only know how to spend their man's money. So upon learning this, Tommy begins to talk about when women get their period, they go crazy, and then Angela decides to do just that, and she smashes up the dinner table before Tommy calms her down by saying her, and I quote, "Tits look great in that tiny bra. You want to talk like an irrational woman down? Tell her she's hot. It solves everything." Now, in a superior show, this scene would be shown as an example of Tommy's reductiveness, his idiocy. But in Landman, it's a shining example of Tommy being this golden-tongued master who can navigate his way through any kind of rough terrain. And also, he's right. Women are irrational. Women are forever the punchline that Tommy is knocking this bit of fun out of. And that's relentless in its stupidity.
Well, you know, something else that was relentless in its stupidity is the daughter, and that whole scene where she gets accepted into that college. I was dumbfounded is probably the right word. Because I was like, she doesn't seem for me to fit into what Landman is. She plays a really unintelligent young woman.
And also, it's done in a way, they're supposed to, I guess, offer the comic relief. They're supposed to be the comic relief, I guess. But there is this bit where she's accepted into the college, but she comes up against this plain trousered, mean suited lady, this dean of admissions who also is a proto-feminist and cannot bear Ainsley's bizarre but supposedly hilarious chat about creating some kind of master race between cheerleaders and football players. But still wants to go to college. And of course, she gets to go to college because she is a cheerleader and also because her daddy is paying her way. And daddy's always saved the day for their little girls in this utterly conservative hellscape that is Landman.
Yeah, it's weird. It doesn't really know what it wants to be. It is kind of stuck between this sort of lowbrow soap opera, you know, the dinner table scene, and then this, what could be a very compelling father-son drama. You know, the stuff where, you know, Tommy and his son finally kind of getting to bond. Like, you know, there's a hint of something special there. But I think it especially with the Ainsley and Angela stuff, like, it's laughing a little too hard at its own misshapen brand of tacky, sleazy humour. And I think that's impossible to get. I mean, at times, I can't believe Taylor Sheridan has become like this. He's kind of worse than Ryan Murphy. He started to indulge all of
Hang
his,
on.
You know. Okay, right. Okay, so they're tied. But I just want to go back to the glimpses of something great. I think most of them actually come from Sam Elliott, who's playing TL, Tommy's father in this. And I mean, I just want to say, his character is very fond of a Texan sunset and gets very upset when he doesn't actually get to enjoy that. I would watch a sunset every day with Sam Elliott. He has the best scenes.
I was just about to say that. I was like, I was trying to think of something positive to say, and I was like, Sam Elliott. Sam Elliott's so good.
There's a story element introduced. There's a family tragedy up ahead. I won't give too much away if you are interested in watching it. But Tommy has to reconnect with his father TL, and TL is in the retirement home when we first meet him. And really, the only joy that he has in his day is being literally wheeled out to watch the sunset at 6:30, and then he says something, you know, completely, you know, something surprisingly profound for this series. Where that story goes, I'm worried that Sam Elliott will just be infected by all of the crudeness around him. He probably will. But just having him here, you know, maybe gives it an extra star.
I just feel that Billy Bob Thornton is better than this, and I feel like Demi Moore is better than
100%.
This.
100%. They all are. And Sam Elliott, of course.
And Sam Elliott, obviously.
Yeah. And I think maybe John Hamm had a lucky escape. I'm out of here, guys. And you know, Demi Moore is now too much of a hot prospect to degrade herself with this material that Sheridan is giving her and is giving. He's spinning this for a MAGA crowd. You know that. Mm. I mean, that's who he is appealing to. And it's supposed to be Dallas-like, but it's not even there for me at all. It doesn't have any kind of, can't be fun about it at all. It's not a fun watch. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that the country of America doesn't get a third season sometimes. And I'm like, I don't want to, like, they need to save us from the indignity of this show.
Okay, that's fair. Well, how many stars then, so?
I think it's just empty headed. I can look, Billy Bob, he can play these sorts of roles in his sleep. I mean, this role was actually written for him, and I suppose he plays it well, but this is bad television made by talented people. Mm-hmm. And that's what upsets me. The amount of talent here. Maybe 2 stars, that extra one for Sam Elliott.
Okay, that's fair, Jen.
It's a one. It's a one and done. And I think Billy Bob is great. And he can do this really well. If you want to, you could go along with this man. You feel like he is that charming, but I don't want to. So one.
One. Okay, that's fair. Now, a gear switch now. The second series of A Man on the Inside has just landed on Netflix, and it's from The Good Place creator Michael Schur, and it stars the always charming Ted Danson. And did you know that the series is based on a Chilean documentary, The Mole Agent, following a lonely retired professor who finds a new purpose as an undercover detective? It's series 2, so they must be doing something right. Jen, we're used to quick fire dialogue from Michael Schur. I love him. He's created some of my favourite TV shows. This is kind of different. How well does this kind of gentler pace work for you?
Yeah, you know what you're getting with this season 2 now. It's this is not high stakes fare, people. This is as gentle as a kitten's cough. I mean, and it's very much, we're tapping into the success of Only Murders in the Building. You know that. It's warm, but I think a lot of people, there's a time and a place for TV that is a little bit more low key and empathetic and slow paced, but I do think it might be at the expense of how good we know that like Mike Schur shows can be. I mean, there are moments of humour, but the joke ratio, it's not that scattergun laugh out loud effect that you would know from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And the comedy, it's fairly slow paced, and even though he has these surefire comic actors, it's so lovely to watch Ted Danson, and especially with the addition of, you know, Mary Steenburgen and his real life wife, and you can watch them flirt it up on screen, and she's this new, she's this kooky, kooky with a capital K, music professor in the college, and the new case he's taken on. And that's gorgeous, because it, but it also kind of similarly reflects with Only Murders, where you have Martin Short and Meryl Streep together fizzing up the screen. So you know what he's going for here. It's it's not reinventing the wheel. It's calm down TV.
All right, let's have a listen. This is Ted Danson as Charles, and he confronts a man and his girlfriend whom he's been watching at a hotel bar.
Oh, what's going on?
This guy bought me a drink. Says you're no good for me.
Oh, yeah. Mind your own business, Grandpa.
Well, that's the thing, Steve. This is my business. See, I'm a private investigator. I was hired by your wife, Donna, to figure out whether you were having an affair. And since that's not Donna, it seems like you are. Yeah, married. Last week, when he canceled your dinner because he was called into surgery, he was actually at his kid's dance recital. And he's not a surgeon. He manages a Pep Boys.
Hey, look, I don't know what she's paying you, but I will double it if you forget what you saw here tonight. Plus, free oil changes for life.
That's not how this works, chum. You see, private investigators like myself, we obey a strict code of honor. We don't do this for the money. We do this to pursue the truth, because the truth is all that... Oh, geez. I'm so sorry. My legs asleep. That ever happened to you? Oh, man, I must have sat on that stool too long.
You know, I laughed out loud at that. You know what I mean? It's so silly, but it was so funny. And I just, I love Ted Danson so much. Like, he's brilliant, isn't he?
He is, yeah. And I mean, he will keep you watching here. I think the first season of A Man on the Inside, it, you know, on the surface, it pretended to be about this elderly guy who fancies himself as a bit of a spy. And the spy stuff was actually quite fun. You know, each of the episode titles was actually a reference to a real life mystery or spy thriller. But really what it was about was a man learning to reconnect with his loved ones, realizing that, you know, he's not quite done with living, and just kind of, you know, after the death of his wife, he's been a widower for a couple of years, just kind of learning to embrace life again and embrace new challenges. And I think it did everything it needed to, and it wrapped up its story beautifully. So I don't think it needed a second spin of the wheel. It kind of feels like Michael Schur or Ted Danson saying, well, look, I was nominated for Golden Globe, Screen Actors Guild Award. You know, this was one of the most popular comedies on Netflix last year. Let's do it again. I don't think they should have, because in doing, you know, the undercover gig, I mean, Charles this time is pretending to do the job that he actually did, which is a professor of engineering at a university, to find, you know what, we won't even get into what he's actually doing. He's trying to solve some crime. It's far too convoluted. I think they've kind of forgotten the mission statement and the point. And as beautiful as it is to see Steenburgen and Danson together, you know, it always will be. They could have no script and you'd still watch them. I think they're missing the retirement setting of that first season, because that, for me, that retirement home that Danson was in, surrounded by all of these esteemed actors of some of the greatest sitcoms ever filmed, that was what made it, you know, snap, crackle and pop for me. That was the reason I fell for this season. This one, not so much.
It's kind of very hot right now, isn't it, to have all these kind of iconic older actors playing these, you know, particular people in Only Murders in the Building, you know, set in nursing homes. What's Richard Osman's?
Oh, yeah. The Tuesday Murder Club.
It seems to be kind of very in right now for the older actors that we've kind of been, you know, grown up. Do you think there's a time limit on that?
Potentially. I think Only Murders does it better than anybody else. That chemistry that you have between Short and Martin and Selena Gomez as well, you know, they're certainly ahead in the joke department. I think that's what actually lets it down, and Jen mentioned this, is if you are going to have you know, a sitcom like this where it gets very, very complicated with its actual crime, you need some proper zingers to keep us entertained, and I think that show is lacking in that department.
Okay, so how many stars?
I'd give Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen 4 or 5 stars, but unfortunately they're kind of stuck in a 2.5 star show.
Okay.
If you want to see Ted Danson in another amateur private eye series, there's a much superior one, Bored to Death. Absolutely stunning. One of the greatest, most underrated shows ever. And he is absolutely brilliant in it. I think you should check that out instead. That's available 3 seasons on Sky Comedy. This, not so much. It's a poor facsimile, I think, of the genius of Bored to Death for me. And I think, you know, with sure he can, if he can come back with something striking and fun in season 3, I wouldn't count him out. You can't count out someone like that and a powerhouse like Ted Danson, who is a dazzling presence on screen, and you always want to see more of him. So I would give it a 2.
All right. Okay. Jen Gannon, Chris Bosser, it's always a pleasure to talk to the two of you. The Death of Bunny Munro is on Sky and Now TV. Landman season 2 is on Paramount Plus, and A Man on the Inside is streaming on Netflix. De La Soul, the pioneering American hip-hop group whose playful sampling, inventive lyricism and jazz rap influence helped redefine the genre from the late 1980s onward. Their new album, Cabin in the Sky, is their first since the loss of a founding member, making it a significant and emotionally charged moment in their story. From there, we move to Aerosmith, one of the most recognisable American rock bands of all time, returning with One More Time. Their first new studio music is more than a decade, and what's grabbed attention is a collaboration with Youngblood, a meeting of classic rock icons and a younger genre-bending disruptor. And finally, to Stray Kids, the self-producing K-pop powerhouse, who after breaking global sales records and even stepping into the Marvel Universe, released their new 5-track mixtape, Do It, which has already surpassed 1 million pre-saves on Spotify. And to take us through all three, we're joined by Neil Doherty, presenter of Saturday Sounds on RTÉ Radio 1. Neil, it's so lovely to have you in.
Oh, Ciara, great to see you.
Now, obviously, you just heard me speak to BP Fallon there and we played the Stone Roses track. You know, what do you make of the passing of Manny?
Yeah, it's really sad. And, you know, the things that BP said there are what I've heard everyone say today. So BP said a walking hug. I heard people say he had style, he had swagger, a warm heart, a one-off. And Paul Weller was saying something about him being the secret sauce in the recipe that was the Stone Roses, which kind of says it all.
Absolutely. I'll be cancelling my brother for the weekend because he was a huge Stone Roses fan. Now, let's start with De La Soul. So this is De La Soul's first album since the passing of Trugoy, right? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Correct, yeah.
He was a founding member and he had such a defining voice. How present is that loss in the emotional kind of feel of this record?
Yeah, like it's worth saying how big these guys were in the late 80s and the early 90s. So MTV was huge and they just they used that medium. They had style, they had great clothes, they had great hair, they had a great sound, and they just captured a whole audience and they re-energized hip hop. And yeah, sadly 2 years ago, back in 2023, he's known as Trugoy, he's known as Dave, he's known as Trugoy the Dove. Dave Joliker, he died in 2023. He was only 54 years of age. And yeah, this is the first album they've made since his death. How present is he? Well, some of the tracks on this album, they feature unreleased recordings of him. And I think the whole album is about him. So it's called Cabin in the Sky. You could sort of rename it Party in the Sky because it's a big celebration about this man's life and his contribution to hip hop.
Mm-hmm. Look, De La Soul, they've always been pioneers of kind of the eclectic, they sample, you know, rich hip hop. Do you hear that classic DNA shining through on Cabin in the Sky?
Oh yeah. So they start with the most bizarre and incredible opening track. So somehow they got Giancarlo Esposito on this. Amazing. Doing a piece of spoken word. So if you think you recognise that name, yes, he was the man who played Gustavo Fring in Breaking Bad, the psychopathic drug cartel drug manufacturer, who will always be very scary to a lot of people who watch Breaking Bad, even though he's been doing softer rom-coms on Netflix. But they open with him doing this spoken word piece, which is almost a little bit like Baz Luhrmann's sunscreen, and he's doing a roll call of
honor.
It
is a roll call, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And very sadly, it ends with the words, "Is there a Dave here? Is there a Dave here?" And there's no answer. That's the last words, and that is an ode to Trugoy.
Mm-hmm. I was listening to the album today, and it brought me back to being a teenager, and it brought me back to that whole world of hip hop that I knew nothing about. But I didn't realise that I needed to go back to the 90s.
Yes.
Kind of so much as well. And there's a brilliant track that I loved. We might play a clip of it now. This is You Don't Stop. I did not pronounce that very cool at all.
scarred with the seeds that we dropped. When we talking that shit, they
rockin', don't stop.
So we kept on going, all the while knowing it could start an evolution.
I just think there's such a nostalgic feel to that. That was You Don't Stop by De La Soul from Cabin in the Sky. Does Cabin in the Sky feel like a continuation of their legacy or the start of like a new chapter? Shaped by the challenges they face that we talked about.
Yeah, it's funny, even though it's a celebration of Trugoy's life and they're mourning his passing, they're still doing what they always did. The Guardian today, I think, said it's vitamin D for the soul. And that's it. You feel like you're back in the 90s. It has joy, it has optimism, it has hope, there's playfulness, there's cheekiness.
There's brilliant samples.
Yes, they're confident, they're calm. They sample Natalie Cole, This Will Be, at one stage. And you're just thinking, I did not expect to hear Natalie Cole on this album. But then, if you think about it, yeah, it could be there because that's what these guys do.
And do you remember Jay-Z's Hard Knock Life?
Yes,
right,
yes.
And a sample to Annie or whatever. I kind of had the same feeling. Now, I'm not comparing the two songs, but I listened to Patta Cake on the album, right? And I was like, do I love this or do I hate this? Because literally, they are, you know, they created the song around Patta Cake, Bake Me a Cake.
Yes. So they've taken a sort of a childhood rhyme and they've given it, I suppose, what you might call some gritty modern realism. And it's Patta Cake, Patta Cake with cigarettes and more than cigarettes and the brutal realities of life. And you think, why do they have to adapt this one? But it kind of works. Again, it's that there's something childish and playful about them.
You see, that's it. And both myself and yourself agreed, Different World is an amazing track. Well, we have a listen to it.
I love that.
Focus, no longer at odds with staying hard in life. Greener the side where your guards in life. Blessed to be intact with change and have an insight to aim. I'm in a different world.
That was A Different World. And for listeners like who maybe haven't followed De La Soul since the 90s, how accessible do you think this album is, Neil? Does it invite new fans in or does it reward like the longtime faithful more?
I'd say it could do both very easily. Like, you do not have to be a De La Soul fan to get on board with this album at all. You just hit play and it's there and you're in.
Okay, so how many stars out of five are we talking?
For bringing me back to being a hip-hoppy little 10-year-old in the 90s, I'm going to go 4 out of 5 stars.
We were probably two of the most unlikely hip-hoppy Irish people in the 90s, Neil, in fairness. Like, you know, and just to also remind people as well, De La Soul won a Grammy. I cannot think of the year that they won the Grammy for this, but for Gorillaz, Feel Good Inc.
That's
you know
right.
what I mean?
Which collabed with them.
People might recognise that song as well. So, sorry, how many stars out of five?
4 out of 5. It's a solid album.
4 out of 5. Okay, that is great. Now we're going to move on to the next album, and that is Aerosmith. Okay, and they released new music, and I can't get over this because they have released new music with Youngblood. Which is definitely a partnership that I never saw coming. What struck you about that partnership?
Yeah, it surprised me straight away. So Youngblood is this 28-year-old English singer-songwriter, a young rocker from Doncaster in England. And you might have seen his name in the news this week because he's actually cancelled the rest of his tour until the end of this year because of health concerns. I think he's kind of burning himself out a little bit. And he's got a social conscience. He's often talking about the price of fans have to pay for tickets. Anyway, him and Steven Tyler of Aerosmith have formed this unlikely bromance. And when you hear Steven Tyler talking about Youngblood, it's so funny. He says he felt electricity when he met him. And he also says, and he says this is a cliche, he felt like a brother from another mother. And I was thinking, well, what is it about the pair of them? And then when you listen to the tracks, you have the two of them singing side by side, sometimes together, sometimes in a call and response way. And you realise that Youngblood is potentially just a young Steven Tyler. Tyler, in terms of the vocals.
So again, I was listening to it today and I was brought back to the 90s.
Yes.
And I cannot believe, I saw Aerosmith and Youngblood and I was like, what on earth? I loved this. Really, really love this. But again, though, there's a bit of a trend here. It's because it reminds me of the 90s.
Yeah, and they really lean into that. So big ballads, the full sound, the raspy voice of both men, the loud rocky vibe. I heard someone say that this is not for the unconverted. So this will really please people who liked Aerosmith when Aerosmith were at their height. Probably we're totally talking 25 years ago, but it's not going to bring anyone new in. I liked it, my only question was, who is it for and is it for now? It just didn't feel very modern.
Well, it doesn't feel very modern at all, but like, why don't we give people a little taste of this particular song? It's called My Only Angel. So that is the opening track of One More Time, That's My Only Angel, and that is Aerosmith and Youngblood. Neil, you're going to stay with me because we need to talk about K-pop in just a minute. You're listening to Friday Night Serena with me, Ciara King, and I'm joined in studio by Neil Doherty. Neil, we're going to talk about Stray Kids. They're a big, massive K-pop band. Let's hear a little flavour of them. Go get a metal boot, you know, down with. Shit, penguin, jungle, darling, in a flawless. I wish you'd been dead away, the pebble, no, miss out. Let's make it fuck, good, in a prank, low. Go digging, pan, little, got good, jungle, low. Hey, yeah, Jim, what's in the best step? Dip it, no, so don't put jungle. Baby, trust our instincts. Feel the rhythm of a bass moving, baby, right this instant. Okay, so that was a little flavour of Stray Kids. They are a massive K-pop band. Now, Neil, I'm going to be honest with you, K-pop went over my head. Mm. But let's talk about them, because even before this was released, it passed a million pre-saves, their album. Does the music live up to the sense of global anticipation and how big this band actually are?
I think I'm a little bit like you. K-pop passed me by. When you hear that sound, it's so well produced. They were
two of us were bopping around.
Yeah,
in
we actually were, and I surprised myself there. Yeah, they're a global sensation. They were formed on a reality TV show in Korea, and they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I struggle to define what they are. It's a bit Eurovision-y. It's a bit the 1975. It's a bit of everything.
And there's a Marvel connection as well, which kind of boggled my mind today.
Yeah, that's
when I was
right.
Kind of looking them up and
one
stuff like that.
One of their songs was used in Marvel, and then two of the stars from Marvel appeared in one of their videos as a sort
which
of a trade-off.
Which stars from Marvel?
It was Hugh Jackman, and it was Ryan Reynolds as well.
Okay, so two pretty big stars of the Marvel universe or whatnot. Neil Doherty, it is always a pleasure. That is it for Arena this evening. Research was by Leah Murphy. Our broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. Paul Murnock was on sound, and the programme was produced by Sheila O'Callaghan.